This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Professor Jos Bland Hawthorne from the University of Sydney has been one of our plenary speakers this week, and he's been talking about the large-scale environment of galaxies. And I understand you're particularly interested in the gas and the baryonic matter and how that's come to be in galaxies.
Yes, that's right. So the universe began with dark matter and what we call baryons. Baryons are just particles like electrons and protons that make up atoms. And the universe began with a certain amount of dark matter, a certain amount of baryons. And over billions of years, the dark matter began to clump into structures. We call those halos, dark matter halos. And then somewhere in this process, the gas began to fall in. And when the gas falls in, it starts to cool and it forms stars. So that's what we end up with today. If you look around today, you see galaxies in all directions. We live in a big galaxy. And our own galaxy is made up of gas that's formed stars. It just so happens that we live around one of those stars. And of course, we're surrounded by a gigantic dark matter halo. So my lecture was about that relationship between dark matter and gas, or more generically, baryons, since the Big Bang. So this is becoming a very exciting topic. We've known about that dark matter exists for 70 or 80 years. We don't actually see dark matter, we just infer its presence through gravity. So, for example, if you see something moving around in a circular orbit and there's nothing in the center of that orbit, you infer there must be something holding onto it. And in this case, it would be a black hole or it would be dark matter. So, as we look around the universe, we infer the presence of dark matter all over the place. Dark matter is in clusters of galaxies. There's dark matter in groups of galaxies. There's great sheets of dark matter. There's great filaments of dark matter. And we don't, as I say, we don't see it, but what we do have are very sophisticated numerical simulations that show how the universe evolves in the presence of dark matter and how you end up with all the structure that we infer from the universe around us. But what's not clear is the relationship of the gas to that dark matter. The dark matter is 6 times more prevalent, more common by mass throughout the universe, so the dark matter dominates how these things happen. And somehow the gas falls into dark matter, and this starts very early indeed. So even within, say, 100 million years of the Big Bang, remember the universe is almost 14 billion years old. So within the first 100 million years, dark matter began to form these small clumps, and then the gas fell in and formed the first stars. The reason we know that is because as we look to very high redshifts, as we look deep into the universe, we find that the gas, the cold gas that should be there, has been mostly turned into warm gas by radiation. And the only way we can see to do that is by there having been a first generation of stars. We also see that there are metals. Everywhere you look, you see carbon. You see silicon and sulfur in the very high redshift universe. The only way to get those metals is from the centers of stars. Those metals were not produced by the Big Bang. So there must have been an early phase in the universe when dark matter formed clumps, gas fell in, produced these very high mass stars, which then warmed up the early gas to make it relatively invisible to us so we could see through it, and also produced metals that enriched that gas in the high redshift universe. So we have an inkling of what happened very early on, but what's not at all clear is what happened next. Dark matter carried on clumping together. More and more dark matter would fall together, and dark matter galaxies would become bigger and bigger and bigger. And presumably, as the gravity got stronger and stronger, more and more gas was able to fall into these dark matter halos. But the sequence of events from the Big Bang to the present time is, as far as we can tell, really very complex indeed. And at the moment, we're struggling with computer simulations to get the dark matter right. We think we have a dark matter universe models that look right. We don't know for sure because we can't see dark matter, only infer its presence. But what we are now trying to do is to install gas into these simulations. But gas physics is very complicated, and we're not at all convinced that our simulations of how gas falls into dark matter are correct.
Because the dark matter is just purely gravity.
It does, and it's purely gravity. It just pulls the gas in. And you need to have the gas fall in, because the gas must fall in to form stars. One thing we're sure of is that you never get stars forming outside of dark matter. You don't get a gas cloud and stars in the middle of it. We've never found one like that ever. The only stars we ever see are associated with gas that fell into dark matter.
So the dark matter is key to the accretion of sufficient mass to then produce stars.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So there's a real mystery there. And rather than just running computer simulations that get more and more sophisticated, another approach is to look out in the universe with bigger and bigger telescopes and learn more about what there is to be found out about the universe, learn more about the gas, learn more about stars in general. But you can also go deep into the universe. You can look back in time. Light has this remarkable property that it carries information. Light is also a constant speed. So if you look nearby in the universe, you learn about things now. But if you look deep into the universe, the light has been traveling so long that, in fact, you're learning about something which happened a very long time ago. So using, say, the Hubble Space Telescope, we can look back in deep space and learn about the early universe, or even big ground-based telescopes like the Keck Telescope. We can look out into space and look back to the early universe. And we also try to compare what we learn from that with simulations of the early universe. So what my talk was about, really, was about how this may have happened, the sequence of events in which gas would fall into the dark matter and form stars. What's interesting about that in particular is that we know the universe by mass has about 16% of what we would call baryons. And the trouble is we only see a fraction of that. Maybe we only see, of that 16%, maybe we only see a quarter of it. Maybe we only see a tenth of it. Depends who you believe. So the question is, why don't we see the remainder of these baryons? Where are they? They're seemingly invisible throughout the universe, although I might say that people are beginning to claim to find this stuff. And so my talk was about trying to explain the galaxies we see today, at the same time trying to explain why so much of the baryons never fell in and were rendered invisible throughout the universe.
So how do we infer that some of those baryons really are baryons if we can't see them? How do you separate them from the dark matter?
Yes, so in fact it's very difficult, because what we've now realized is these baryons that are missing from galaxies, the vast majority of them in fact, these baryons are at temperatures like 100,000 degrees. And at 100,000 degrees, that gas emits in a part of the spectrum, what's called the extreme ultraviolet, which is extremely difficult to detect directly. In fact, extreme ultraviolet emission, direct emission, is almost impossible, really. What you see is you see the gas in absorption. What that means is if you look towards a distant quasar, you don't look for lines that peak up in the spectrum. You look for lines that are in absorption, where the quasar's light has been, some of the light has been taken away, and you see a dip in the spectrum. And we see lots of these little dips in quasar spectra. We just use the quasar as a background light source coming through the universe. And these little dips tell us about the presence of this warm, invisible gas. So, I mean, we infer it's there, but we don't really see it directly. So the idea is that there's a lot of warm gas around galaxies, not in galaxies, around groups and around clusters of galaxies. And what I raised was the issue of whether this gas is in fact distributed on much larger scales than just around the galaxies that we see, and that this gas has a certain motion. It in fact is streaming towards galaxies in these bizarre thin streams, or filaments we call them. And what's interesting about that is we've never actually seen these streams or filaments, but people do generally believe that's how gas gets into galaxies. But that's purely based on computer models. It's never been seen directly. So part of my talk was devoted to trying to understand why you don't see these filaments so easily today. And in fact, what you'd have to do to actually find these filaments. Or in fact, that's the wrong picture. Filaments may be not the way, or fingers of gas may be not the way this stuff gets in. It may be, in fact, that in many cases the gas never got into galaxies. Or in some other cases, the gas got in and then was ejected.
Is it simply too hot to collapse in?
That's one idea. Although people think that if the gas does get hot, it will eventually cool. So you should see gas raining in from a dark halo, sort of a dark halo full of warm, hot gas. It cools and then floods in. But my work has shown over the years that you cannot associate that picture with anything you see today. Like cold clouds around the galaxy, like the high-velocity clouds, these have nothing to do with hot accretion cooling down and giving you rain onto the galaxy. So something else is going on. So my talk focused on those sorts of issues, like where is this gas? Maybe the gas in some cases came in and was ejected as warm gas. In other cases, the gas stayed warm and never got in the first place. And I basically built up a picture of what this is telling us about the way galaxies form. And in time, we'll be able to see if my ideas are correct or not.
So what sort of instrumentation is now being developed or used to try and test this stuff out?
You've asked the right person about this. So I mentioned before that the extreme ultraviolet emission was essentially invisible. Well, I'm working with my team in Australia. We build instruments. And we also work with NASA with various colleagues. And we've been thinking about a balloon experiment that we could launch next year that would have some special technology, photonic technology, that would allow us to see this extreme ultraviolet emission directly. I mean, there are other people who've tried to do this. I have a very impressive colleague at Caltech called Chris Martin. He has looked at doing this with an experiment he calls Fireball on a balloon, maybe even on a satellite. I'm not sure where he's got with that, but we are thinking about a balloon first and a satellite later. And my group already has a small satellite that's been built and we intend to launch next year. But we will start with a bigger experiment on a balloon that we'll launch with NASA from Australia. And we'll try to detect this ultraviolet emission directly, because you really have to get above the Earth's atmosphere. The Earth's atmosphere absorbs ultraviolet.
But is it also then, even when you get above the Earth's atmosphere, do you find most of it's been extinguished on its way?
That's a very good question. So the galaxy itself also absorbs ultraviolet light. But there are, in fact, directions all over the sky where the absorption from the galaxy is low. So we basically look in those windows where we know that the ultraviolet absorption is lower than other places. And it just turns out there happens to be a lot of holes in the medium of the gas of our galaxy where you can see through to the distant universe. So I'm quite confident about that because we have a new approach to detecting ultraviolet emission directly.
I was going to ask because which probably mentioned there was an RAS medal awarded to you related to instrumentation. So presumably it's quite novel what you're doing.
Yeah. So yes, I was awarded before my plenary talk. I was awarded the Jackson Wilt Medal for experimental astrophysics, and that medal really recognises effort by myself and by my colleagues. Really, to be fair, the medal was given to me, but I have a number of colleagues who've been tremendously helpful over the years in Australia. And what we have done is to explore the use of photonics. Optics is where you shine light through lenses and you reflect off mirrors. Photonics is when you shine light through materials that can bend and flex. One of my colleagues refers to photonics as the science of molding the flow of light, which I like.
Okay.
Molding the flow of light. So there's actually a review article that I wrote coming out in Physics Today, this issue, the May issue of 2012, which you can read about this work. So the idea of using photonics to guide light and split up light and process light is not entirely new. Astronomers have used fibers for decades to take light from stars or galaxies and bring them together onto the instrument. But we've gone much, much further than that. You know, we use laser combs, which are frequency combs. We use what are called ring resonators, optical circulators, array waveguides, fiberbrack gratings. There are so many technologies that we're exploring. Vortex coronagraphs, and I could just keep going on and on. We've actually invented a device which has had a major impact in experimental physics called a photonic lantern. This is where you take a normal fiber, a multimode fiber, where light can go through it in many different ways, But what it does is convert all that light into single mode output. And that's, of course, what telecom uses to transmit signals all around the world into TV sets, telephone lines, and so on. So if you want to tap into telecom technology to do light processing, you need to go from multi-mode signal, where light can move around in many different ways, to a single-mode propagation, where light can only move in one direction.
It's all about increasing the sensitivity, then, is it?
It is indeed, yes. So we're able to break down multi-mode light into single-mode outputs, and these single-mode outputs feed into conventional telecom devices or devices that I develop in my own lab. So we've taken photonics in astronomy to a new level, and we've also taken photonics in space to a new level, because we have instruments that we're building for space and on balloons, which are entirely made up of photonic components. So this field is known as astrophotonics, but others similarly refer to it as space photonics. So it's become a very exciting new field, because it gives us entirely new ways of looking at astronomical instrumentation. So for example, a typical spectrograph today that wants to work at extremely high spectral sampling resolution, these instruments are 6 meters in size or larger. We can reduce that entire instrument down to something which is the size of a shoebox.
Okay.
And this will happen, I think, more and more in the future. So in other words, our instruments now are independent of the telescope or the application. They're just very small boxes. So it sounds too good to be true, and it is. The one thing that we're missing right now are detectors that are specialized for our micro spectrographs, our little spectrographs. And we are now engaged in trying to develop detectors which are specific to our kinds of little instruments. Once those detectors are finished and made, hopefully in a couple of years, then our little boxes will be as powerful as any 6 meter telescope instrument in the world.
Wow. That probably leads right into the next question I was going to ask. You see then these being used a lot on the next generation of telescopes, or even the current generation of telescopes?
Yes indeed. At the moment, instruments scale with the telescope. So for example, a 2 meter telescope might have an instrument which measures 1 meter in length. Now, 2 meters means the mirror of the telescope is 2 meters wide. And the instrument might be 1 meter in length. If you go to a 4 meter telescope, its instrument now might be 2 meters in length. If you go to a 10-meter telescope, that instrument now is like 5 meters in length. That's just a very rough scaling at a particular sort of performance. And what I've shown in papers since 2006, 2007, is if you use photonics, the instrument can be always kept small. Size of a shoebox. In fact, one of the papers says, "Shoebox spectrograph, one size fits all," I think is the title of the paper. So now, basically, what we've done is to separate how instruments grow from how telescopes grow, which is very exciting, because it means on the ELTs, the extremely large telescopes, which are going to be 30, 40 meters in diameter at most, you'd expect instruments to be enormous. I don't know, say 20 meters in length, or 10, depends on what you're trying to do. Of course, they'll be less than that, 6 meters or so. But what we've shown is that the same box, the same shoebox concept, should work equally well on a 30-meter telescope. But we are waiting for certain kinds of detectors to be manufactured before we can really pull this off.
Yeah, and although we don't always like to think about the cost, is this something that's going to then ultimately be more cost-effective than the very large instruments?
Yes. At the moment, it's not quite as cheap as we'd like. But what we're really hoping is that industry will pick up. So I have patents on some of this stuff, which was supposed to encourage industry to step up and engage us. And that's now begun to happen. We've got sort of Canadian companies, in particular medical companies, that are working with us to make photonic instruments commercially. So if that happens, and it all washes through and everything works out the way that I anticipate, then the cost should come down enormously. So then, let's say that each shoebox allows 2 or 3 or 4 fibers, maybe 10 fibers, to come into it. And let's say you wanted to have 1,000 fibers on the sky, then you would essentially buy 100 shoeboxes, which would pack together in a very small volume. So that's sort of a modular approach to building instruments, and It could be very inexpensive if industry comes to our aid.
All right, well, some very exciting future prospects there. We're a bit low on photons right now, so maybe
yes,
we should wrap up the interview there.
Right, the lights have gone out.
Thank you very much.
All right.